custodians of the planet, acknowledge and pays respect to the past, present, and future traditional custodians and elders of this nation, and the continuation of cultural, spiritual, and educational practices of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. You are with Custodians of the Planet. I'm Denise Yildiz. Custodians of the Planet brings consciousness to planetary challenges and looks at different perspectives regarding the tensions and harmony of human activities in a changing climate. This is the sound of glacial calving, or a crying glacier. Earth's glaciers are melting much faster than scientists thought. To put it simply, and we will talk about this in more detail, fast melting glaciers influence sea level rise, and sea level rise has severe consequences for Australia and its neighbors. If you want to see climate change, maybe glaciers can be the best place to be looked at. Today, Helen Amanda Fricker joins us, a glaciologist focusing on climate change. Helen is a glaciologist and a professor at Scripps Institution of Oceanography at the University of California, San Diego, where she is a director of the Scripps Polar Center. Helen, welcome to Custodians of the Planet. I'm so glad to have you on the show today.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thank you for having me.
To begin with, can you tell us a bit about your job as a glaciologist?
Sure, yes. I'm a glaciologist. I study Earth's ice sheets. I'm also a professor at Scripps Institution of Oceanography. So I mainly do research and teaching. My research involves using satellites to look at the Antarctic ice sheet to see whether it's losing mass or gaining mass. The reason being that if Antarctica is losing mass, then that mass goes into the ocean as water and sea level rises. So yeah, I basically look at many different types of satellite data to understand where on the ice sheet it's changing. And then we also go in on the ground with field work to figure out why it's changing, where it is, and what are the processes that are causing that loss.
Yeah, sounds really interesting. What inspired you to look at glaciers?
Well, many years ago, I was actually at UNSW, and I was working on a project looking at so the instrument I use is called an altimeter, and it measures the surface height of the Earth. And we were doing that in the Simpson Desert in Australia, actually. And we were calibrating the instrument with GPS. And, you know, it was really exciting because I really love Earth science, but it wasn't really very meaningful. I mean, I didn't really see where that was going in a sort of societal way. What, you know, there wasn't going to be an impact in what I knew. And I really wanted to do more to understand Antarctica. I'd done a project the previous year looking at icebergs in remote sensing data and just satellite imagery, actually, just basically looking at photographs taken from space to see where icebergs were going in the Southern Ocean. And so bringing the two things together, the sort of knowledge of Antarctica that I got from the iceberg tracking project and the altimetry experience that I'd got from my Simpson Desert project at UNSW, I decided that it'd be really exciting to use altimetry to look at the ice sheet itself and how the ice sheet is changing. So that was my inspiration.
That sounds really cool. What I really like about it is, so you worked on one project and you realized you have much to offer as an impact-wise. And then you worked in another project, and then you merged two projects into one, and you transferred those skills. Yeah, sounds fascinating.
Yeah.
My next question might sound a bit awkward, but I will ask anyway. How does it feel to walk on the Arctic ice?
Yeah, so actually it was the Antarctic that I went to. So it's in the bottom of the earth.
Oh, sorry. I always had this assumption in my head because you're in California right now, you go to Arctic, but obviously you were in Hobart back in the day. Sorry, go on.
Well, we went, first of all, just to get there itself. It was an icebreaker from Hobart. And it took 6 weeks because we did a lot of like marine biology and oceanography on the way. But once you actually get there, it's amazing. I don't think it would be very easy to explain what it's like, apart from just complete and utter stillness and silence, and just this feeling that you're in a place where no one else, very few other people go. That was the solitude and the sort of literally the end of the earth. I mean, you've just crossed this most hostile patch of ocean and huge waves and everything leaving Hobart, and you've just gone until it gets colder and colder, and you've seen ice getting, little platelets of ice on the surface that have got bigger and bigger and bigger, and then eventually a thick layer of ice floating on the ocean, and then the ice sheet and icebergs, and it's just breathtaking. Really breathtaking. And the silence and the kind of just that whole like being just so completely kind of, well, I guess you're on your own, right? I mean, okay, there's people there, there's infrastructure, there's a base and everything, but when you're doing field work in the middle of an ice shelf, which is what we did, I mean, you really have to know how to look after yourself, because if you don't, there's no one coming to help you. So I guess it's this feeling of like power. You feel quite powerful and quite sort of, I mean, you're in this like looking after yourself thing, but it's also just so quiet and so far from everybody. It's amazing.
Yeah, wow. That's so lovely. Is it like a peaceful region, or does it evoke melancholy?
Oh no, absolutely peaceful. I mean, so peaceful. Like, I mean, it's like, I don't know, it's a bit like the beginning of lockdown here when there were no planes flying and people were inside in their houses, and the birds started singing more, and it was just, you're completely and utterly just earth. It's just earth, right? With no humans and no infrastructure. And yeah, it's really, really peaceful.
Yeah, I mean, the glaciological research sounds very niche. I wonder, are there many women, and how does it feel to be a woman in this field?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So when I went to Antarctica in the middle of the 90s, we were on a field team of six people, and actually two of us were women, and I was only 26, and the other woman that came, who was became a very good friend of mine, she was actually only 23. So the two of us were there, and then there were four guys, and they were all much older than us and everything. We actually got kind of split up in the field team because we had two groups, but she and I were allowed, and this was actually very insightful on behalf of the team leader. He let us speak to each other every day on the radio at the end of the day when we checked in, because I think he knew that that was going to be tough for us to kind of be, straight from basically, I mean, she'd just come out of her undergrad degree and I was just kind of starting my PhD, and we were like, suddenly in Antarctica with all these guys. I mean, that was really, really a great thing that he did. But yeah, there aren't that many women, and it has definitely traditionally been a very sort of macho thing to go to Antarctica. I mean, it's a very sort of dominated by white men for sure, but that is really changing. I mean, in the last few years especially, there's been a big push to just increase the equity and just get better gender balance and better balance in race as well, and it's just become much more of an open community, and there's now like harassment policies that are just always up there. I mean, it's sort of come along hand in hand with the Me Too movement as well, and also the Black Lives Matter movement. Like, all of these issues have sort of come to a head, I guess, at this time, and it's come into our field as well, which I think is going to change things for the better.
That's such a brave story. One of you 23 and you 26, so young in Antarctica. That's a great story, and I totally agree. The Me Too movement and Black Lives Matter movement is definitely been reflecting on the gender gap in the workplace. I mean, it's really good to see that shift, I guess, from 90s to now. And it's accelerating for sure with the recent movements and everything. Let's talk a bit about the glaciers. The common knowledge about glaciers is the influence on sea level rise. Can you tell us why and how glaciers matter?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So glaciers, you can think of them like reservoirs of water, but the water's frozen. So glaciers are sitting on top of continents. So, for example, Antarctica, basically there's a big mass of land down there, but it just happens to have an ice sheet on top. And the ice sheet is 2.2 kilometers thick on average. And so it sits on top of the continent and then it's surrounded by ocean. And if you lose more, some of that ice melts. I mean, basically the ice sheet wants to stay the same size. It kind of wants to be in equilibrium. It wants to be just this steady mass of ice at the bottom of the earth. But all the different forces that are acting on it from the atmosphere and the ocean are actually very slowly changing it. And so we have this interplay between ice being added to the ice sheet from snow falling. That's the only way that you get ice added to Antarctica is because snowfall. And it's a very small amount. It's actually a desert, but the large area over which it's integrated puts a lot of ice into that system. And then you lose it again around the edges because the ice flows downslope. Because the continent is sort of sloping underneath the bedrock underneath. And when you reach the edges, you get these large sort of floating platforms of ice that jut out over the ocean called ice shelves. Now, the ice shelves then shed mass through melting, just basal melting underneath and calving. And so what happens is you've got this sort of, it's an equation. It's input, which is snowfall, and then it's output, which is iceberg carving and basal melting. And the sum of those three terms tells you whether you're losing mass to the ocean or not. If the sum is greater than zero, then the ice sheet is gaining mass. If it's less than zero, then the ice sheet is losing mass, and that mass is going into the ocean. And sea level, as a result, because ice is melting and going into the ocean, there's only one way that the ocean can react, and the level of the ocean will rise. So that's why you get sea level rise when Antarctica melts.
So if you would like to understand the relation between climate change and glaciers, I think it's a good time to link these two concepts. How does glaciers respond to a changing climate?
Yeah, so that's interesting because there's two sort of things that can happen. So first of all, in Antarctica, it's very cold and it doesn't snow very much. And the initial sort of response to a slight increase in temperature, atmospheric temperature, is you get more snowfall, right? Mm-hmm. So parts of Antarctica are actually gaining mass because of that, because you're getting increased snowfall over the plateau. So that's one way that the ice sheet responds. But then the other way is the ocean currents are changing. We're getting more warm water. The sort of heat flux coming from the ocean is increasing, and it's all to do with changing winds as well. So you've got this whole system acting together, the atmosphere, the ocean, the ice sheet, all working together to kind of erode the ice sheet around the edges. And that is causing the ice to be lost around the edges. So they respond in different ways. And what you end up with is this sort of interplay between two competing processes, addition of mass through snowfall and then loss of mass through mainly basal melting. And that's how they respond. And overall, almost every ice sheet and glacier that's not in an ice sheet and ice cap, almost every single one of them is retreating. Some of the places in East Antarctica are growing a little bit, but there's not many glaciers like mountain glaciers that every single mountain glacier is responding in a negative way. It's losing mass.
And how does it affect the coastal communities and the ecosystem, like when you think about these responses?
Yeah, I mean, it affects the coastal communities a lot because, I mean, we have so many people living within sort of 1 meter of sea level rise. You think about it, I mean, you think about all mean sea level rise we're talking about. So, you know, you think about places that flood at high tide, and when you get king tides as well. I mean, these places are going to flood more as sea level, because so if the long-term trend is that sea level rises, in other words, you already the sort of benchmark that you start at in these places, these communities, is higher. So just that extra that you get from the tidal signal, and then if you have a storm surge and king tide on top, you're going to end up with more frequent flooding all around the edges. So you end up with extensive coastal flooding during storms, and you get tidal flooding and then coastal erosion as well, because the ocean is sort of coming in and eroding, especially at high tide. So what this means is that there's communities that are essentially going to be completely reshaped because of the fact that the ocean is going to encroach on them. Mm. So it's going to really cause a big, in the next sort of 10 to 20 years, we're going to really, and we're already seeing it in some places. Some places are really impacted already, like the Pacific Islands. You know, we're seeing that the sea level is basically rising all around these islands and making them essentially disappear.
Yeah, that sounds.
And we have a lot of infrastructure. I mean, you know, a lot of in Australia and in, I mean, many places in, you know, in the US where they're all around the, you know, the people live around the edges of in the ocean, right? And airports, things like that, they're going to have to be moved. And the amount of money that is going to be have to spend on this problem, I know people have done economic assessments, but this is a lot.
Yeah, for sure. And speaking of communities, most of the studies are fully on Western bases, and at first you mentioned it's highly dominated by white males. So I wonder if there is a collaboration with indigenous knowledge at the Antarctic or at the Arctic while you're doing any
really
studies.
Yeah, I'm really pleased you asked that question, because there's a lot of discussion about that at the moment, especially in Greenland, because there is local, Antarctica doesn't have local inhabitants. I mean, Antarctica was not a, nobody lived there before we went there and explored it. But Greenland does have people living there. And so we have a lot of local communities that are being directly impacted by what's going on in Greenland. And a colleague of mine, Fiamma Stranio, she works with the locals. I mean, she has fishermen and women, but she has local people involved in the decisions. And it's completely, you can't replace that sort of local knowledge. You need that local knowledge to know like what's safe, where you can go, how you can do measurements. I mean, it's, and also what do they need to know from us? That's the other thing. Like, you can't sort of go in there and start making measurements and not tell them, you know, why and why it's beneficial. And so, yeah, there's definitely a big push to integrate local knowledge to help improve our understanding.
This question is related to the ecosystems. I always wondered if there's a difference between in glaciers of Arctic and Antarctica.
Oh, very much so. So Antarctica is, as I said earlier, it's bedrock with ice on top. So it's an ice sheet. So the South Pole is basically an ice sheet, what we call. Mm-hmm. But it's not sitting on the ocean. So it's ice surrounded by ocean. The Arctic's completely the opposite. It's ocean surrounded by land, right? So the Arctic Ocean is actually sea ice, what we call sea ice. It's frozen ocean. It doesn't sit on bedrock at all. It's the but I think a lot of people don't realize that there is no ice sheet in at the North Pole. It's frozen ocean. And when that ice melts, it doesn't affect sea level because it's already floating. So the changes in the sea ice are really important for the climate system, because you're replacing bright white ice that reflects heat away with dark ocean that absorbs heat, it's called the albedo. That's very important for global climate change, but it's not sea level rise. There is an ice sheet in the Northern Hemisphere, and it's technically in the Arctic, but it's not at the North Pole, and that's Greenland. So there's two ice sheets on Earth today, Greenland and Antarctica.
Okay, now it makes sense. Okay, cool.
Yeah, and the Arctic is where the polar bears are, and the Antarctic is where the penguins are.
Yeah. And I like to seal this conversation with a future-oriented question. What are the prospects do you envision for our grandkids?
Oh, gosh. So I guess I like to leave it on a message. I mean, I think we're in a really hopeful period. Gen Z, they're really incredible. I mean, you know, you see what they have the power to do with their TikTok campaigns. And I mean, I do feel pretty hopeful for the future. I think that, my kids, I have three kids and two of them are teenagers, and all three of my kids are very aware of climate change, and they understand, like, if I drive to the shops rather than walk, that's going to put carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Like, I actually think that the younger generation understand climate change better than the older generation. They get it. They get the cause and effect between, you know, burning fossil fuels and putting that into the atmosphere, which is actually going to change the temperature of the planet. They get it. And they, you know, my daughter the other day, she's like, why do we still invest in this bank? We know they're, you know, things like that. Like, they're really politically, not so political, but science aware, and they get it. They understand it. So I'm pretty hopeful. I really think that if we can cross this sort of, or get through this time where science has become so doubted and people start to really listen to what we're saying, and like, it's just so sad that people still ask the question, oh, do you believe in that? Do you believe in climate change? It's like, I think almost every single teenager that I've ever spoken to believes in climate. I mean, they get it. They understand it.
Yeah, so I totally agree.
I'm hopeful. And I think there are solutions, and there's some really like innovative solutions that are coming for like changing the way that we get our energy and, you know, climate justice, how we actually deal with the problem, that actually it's the poor people in the world that are going to be suffer the most from the effects of climate change. And these are all issues that our kids, they understand them.
True, totally.
I think I'm pretty hopeful, actually. I think, honestly, it would be, you'd feel pretty hopeless otherwise. You just feel like giving up sometimes. So you've got to hold on to that hope, I think.
Yeah, totally. There's no point of being hopeless. That's not helpful or constructive anyway. And the new generation is totally conscious of, you know, what's happening and with their decisions. And
exactly. Yeah.
Helen, thank you for being so generous with your time.
You're really so welcome.
Early autumn in the Canadian Arctic, and polar bears are gathering on the coastal strip, waiting for the sea to freeze. In the far south, autumn can be a particularly savage and unpredictable time. But as the first storms of autumn sweep through the deserted nesting grounds, they bring an unexpected bonanza for the few that remain. Thank you. early autumn in the Canadian Arctic.